constitution of the universe. Because of that duality, Aristotle argued, there are men who are, by their nature, free, and men who are by nature slaves. Today, scientists and other innovators are often portrayed as odd and unconventional. I suppose there is some truth to that stereotype. One physics professor I knew selected his lunch each day from the free offerings at the cafeteria's condiments table. Mayonnaise provided fat, ketchup was his vegetable, and saltines his carbs. Another friend loved cold cuts but hated bread, and at a restaurant had no qualms ordering for lunch a lonely pile of salami, which he would eat with a knife and fork as if it were a steak. Conventional thinking is not a good attitude for a scientist or anyone who wants to innovate, and sometimes that has its costs in the way people view you. But as we will see repeatedly, science is the natural enemy of preconceived notions and of authority, even the authority of the scientific establishment itself. For revolutionary breakthroughs necessarily require a willingness to fly in the face of what everyone else believes to be true, to replace old ideas with credible new ones. In fact, if there is one barrier to progress that stands out in the history of science and of human thought in general, it is an undue allegiance to the ideas of the past and present. And so if I were hiring for a creative position, I'd beware of too much common sense, but I'd count oddball traits in the plus column and keep that condiments table well supplied. Another important clash between Aristotle's approach and that of later science is that it was qualitative, not quantitative. Today, physics is, even in its simple high school form, a science of quantity. Students taking even the most elementary versions of physics learn that a car moving 60 miles an hour is going 88 feet each second. They learn that if you drop an apple, its speed will increase by 22 miles per hour each second that it falls. They do mathematical calculations such as computing that when you plop down into a chair, the force exerted on your spine as the chair stops you can be, for a split second, more than 1,000 pounds. Aristotle's physics was nothing like that. On the contrary, he complained loudly about philosophers who sought to turn philosophy into mathematics. Any attempt to turn natural philosophy into a quantitative pursuit in Aristotle's day was, of course, impeded by the state of knowledge in ancient Greece. Aristotle had no stopwatch, no clock with a second hand, nor was he ever exposed to thinking of events in terms of their precise durations. Also, the fields of algebra and arithmetic that would be needed to manipulate such data were no more advanced than they had been in Thales' time. As we've seen, the plus, minus, and equal signs had not yet been invented, nor had our number system, or concepts like miles per hour. But scholars in the 13th century and later made progress in quantitative physics with instruments and mathematics that were not terribly more advanced. So these were not the only barriers to the science of equations, measurement, and numerical prediction. More important was the fact that Aristotle was, like everyone else, simply not interested in quantitative description. Even when studying motion, Aristotle's analysis was only qualitative. For example, he had just a vague understanding of speed, as in, some things go farther than others in a similar amount of time. That sounds to us like a message we might find inside a fortune cookie, but in Aristotle's time, people considered it precise enough. And with only a qualitative notion of speed, there could only be the foggiest notion of acceleration, which is change in speed or direction, and which we teach as early as middle school. Given these profound differences, if someone with a time machine had gone back and given Aristotle a text on Newton's physics, it would have meant no more to him than a book of microwave pasta recipes. Not only would he have been unable to understand what Newton meant by force or acceleration, he would not have cared. What did interest Aristotle, as he conducted his thorough observations, was that motion and other kinds of change seemed to happen towards some end. He understood movement, for example, not as something to be measured, but as a phenomenon whose purpose could be discerned. A horse pulls on a cart to move it down the road. A goat walks in order to find food. A mouse runs to avoid being eaten. Boy rabbits defile girl rabbits to make more rabbits. Aristotle believed that the universe was one large ecosystem designed to function harmoniously. He saw purpose everywhere he looked. Rain falls because plants need water to grow. Plants grow so that animals can eat them. Grape seeds grow into grapevines and eggs turn into chickens to actualize the potential that exists within those seeds and eggs. From time immemorial, people had always arrived at their understanding of the world through projections of their own experience. And so it was that in ancient Greece it was far more natural to analyze the purpose of events in the physical world than it would have been to try to explain them through the mathematical laws being developed by Pythagoras and his followers. Here again, we see the importance in science of the particular questions you choose to ask. For even if Aristotle had embraced Pythagoras' notion that nature obeys quantitative laws, he would have missed the point because he was simply less interested in the quantitative specifics of the laws than in the question of why objects follow them. What compels the string in a musical instrument or a falling rock to behave with numerical regularity? These were the issues that would have excited Aristotle, and it is here that we see the greatest disconnect between his philosophy and the way science is conducted now. For while Aristotle perceived what he interpreted as purpose in nature, today science does not. That characteristic of Aristotle's analysis, his search for purpose, had a huge influence on later human thought. It would endear him to many Christian philosophers through the ages, but it impeded scientific progress for nearly 2,000 years, for it was completely incompatible with the powerful principles of science that guide our research today. When two billiard balls collide, the laws that were first set forth by Newton, not a grand underlying purpose, determine what happens next. Science first arose from the fundamental human desire to know our world and to find meaning in it, so it's not surprising that the yearning for purpose that motivated Aristotle still resonates with many people today. The idea that everything happens for a reason may give comfort to those seeking to understand a natural disaster or other tragedy. And for such people, the scientist's insistence that the universe is not guided by any sense of purpose can make the discipline of science seem cold and soulless. Yet there is another way of looking at this, and it's the one that I am familiar with from my father. When the issue of purpose would arise, my father often referred not to anything that had befallen him, but to a particular incident my mother had experienced before they met, when she was just 17. The Nazis had occupied her city, and one of them, for a reason my mother never knew, ordered a few dozen Jews, my mother among them, to kneel in a neat row in the snow. He then walked from one end to the other, stopping every few steps to shoot one of his captives through the head. If this were part of God's or nature's grand plan, my father wanted nothing to do with such a God. For people like my father, there can be relief in the thought that our lives, however tragic or triumphant they may be, are all the result of the same indifferent laws that create exploding stars, and that, good or bad, they are ultimately a gift, a miracle that somehow springs from those sterile equations that rule our world. Though Aristotle's ideas dominated thinking about the natural world until Newton's day, over the years there were plenty of observers who cast doubt on his theories. For example, consider the idea that objects not executing their natural motion will only move when a force is acting upon them. Aristotle himself realized that this raised the question of what propels an arrow, a javelin, or any other projectile after the initial impetus. His explanation was that, due to the fact that nature abhors a vacuum, particles of air rush in behind the projectile after the initial impetus and push it along. The Japanese seem to have successfully adapted that idea to pack passengers into Tokyo subway cars, but even Aristotle himself was only lukewarm about his theory. Its weakness became more obvious than ever during the 14th century, when the proliferation of cannons made the idea of air particles rushing behind heavy cannonballs to push them along seem absurd. Just as important, the soldiers firing those cannons cared little about whether it was particles of air or tiny invisible nymphs that pushed their cannonballs along. What they did desire to know was the trajectory their projectiles would follow, and in particular, whether that trajectory would end on the heads of their enemies. This disconnect illustrates the real chasm that stood between Aristotle and those who would later call themselves scientists. Issues like the trajectory of a projectile, its speed and position in various instants, were, for Aristotle, beside the point. But if one wants to apply the laws of physics to make predictions, then those issues are critical. And so the sciences that would eventually replace Aristotle's physics, the ones that would make it possible, among other things, to calculate the trajectory of a cannonball, were concerned with the quantitative details of the processes at work in the world, measurable forces, speeds, and rates of acceleration, not with the purpose or philosophical reasons for those processes. Aristotle knew that his physics was not perfect. He wrote, "Mine is the first step, and therefore a small one, though worked out with much thought and hard labor. It must be looked at as a first step and judged with indulgence. You, my readers, or hearers of my lectures, if you think I have done as much as can fairly be expected of an initial start, will acknowledge what I have achieved, and will pardon what I have left for others to accomplish." Here Aristotle is voicing a feeling he shared with most of the later geniuses of physics. We think of them, the Newtons and Einsteins, as all-knowing and confident, even arrogant about their knowledge. But as we'll see, like Aristotle, they were confused about a lot of things, and, also like Aristotle, they knew it. Aristotle died in 322 BC at age 62, apparently of a stomach ailment. A year earlier, he had fled Athens when its pro-Macedonian government was overthrown after the death of his former student Alexander. Though Aristotle spent 20 years in Plato's academy, he had always felt like an outsider in Athens. Of that city, he wrote, "The same things are not proper for a stranger as for a citizen. It is difficult to stay." With Alexander gone, however, the issue of whether to stay became a critical one, for there was a dangerous backlash directed at anyone associated with Macedon, and Aristotle was aware that the politically motivated execution of Socrates had established the precedent that a cup of hemlock is a potent rebuttal to any philosophical argument. Always a deep thinker, Aristotle had the idea to run rather than risk becoming a martyr. He supplied a lofty reason for his decision, to keep Athenians from once again sinning against philosophy. But the decision, like Aristotle's approach to life in general, was a very practical one. After Aristotle's death, his ideas were passed along by generations of students at the Lyceum and by others who wrote commentaries on his works. His theories faded, along with all learning, during the early Middle Ages, but became prominent again during the High Middle Ages among Arab philosophers, from whom later Western scholars learned of it. With some modifications, his thinking eventually became the official philosophy of the Roman Catholic Church. And so for the next 19 centuries, to study nature meant to study Aristotle. We've seen how our species developed both a brain for asking questions and a propensity to ask them, as well as the tools, writing, mathematics, and the idea of laws, with which to begin to answer them. With the Greeks, by learning to use reason to analyze the cosmos, we reached the shores of a glorious new world of science. But that was only the beginning of a greater adventure of exploration that lay ahead. Part 2. The Sciences. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate, so we must think and act anew. Abraham Lincoln, Second Annual Message, December 1st, 1862. Chapter 6. A New Way to Reason. I've had the enriching experience of collaborating on two books with friends, physicist Stephen Hawking and spiritual leader Deepak Chopra. Their worldviews could not have been further apart if they existed in different universes. My vision of life is pretty much the same as Stephen's, that of the scientist. but it is far different from Deepak's, which is probably why we chose to title our book War of the Worldviews and not Isn't It Wonderful How We Agree on Everything? Deepak is passionate about his beliefs, and in the time we spent traveling together, he was always trying to convert me and questioning my approach to understanding the world. He called it reductionist, because I believe that mathematical laws can, ultimately, explain everything in nature, including human beings. In particular, as I've said, I believe, as do most scientists today, that everything, again including us, is made of atoms and the elementary particles of matter, which interact through the four fundamental forces of nature, and that if one understands how all that works, one can, in principle at least, explain everything that happens in the world. In practice, of course, we have neither enough information about our surroundings nor a powerful enough computer to use our fundamental theories to analyze phenomena like human behavior. So the question of whether Deepak's mind is ruled by the laws of physics must remain an open question. I didn't object in principle to Deepak's characterizing me as reductionist, but I would bristle when he said it, because the way he said it made me feel embarrassed and defensive, as if a soulful person couldn't believe as I did. In fact, at gatherings of Deepak supporters, I sometimes felt like an Orthodox rabbi at a convention of pork producers. I was always being asked leading questions like, "Do your equations tell you what I am experiencing when I look at a painting by Vermeer or listen to a symphony by Beethoven?" Or, "If my wife's mind is really both particles and waves, how do you explain her love for me?" I had to admit I couldn't explain her love for him. But then again, I couldn't explain any love using equations. To me, that is beside the point. For as a tool for understanding the physical world, if not our mental experience, at least not yet, the application of mathematical equations has had unprecedented success. We may not be able to calculate next week's weather by tracing the motion of each atom and applying the fundamental principles of atomic and nuclear physics, but we do have a science of meteorology that uses higher-level mathematical models and isn't too bad at predicting the weather tomorrow. Similarly, we have applied sciences that study the ocean, light and electromagnetism, the properties of materials, diseases, and dozens of other aspects of our everyday world in ways that allow us to put our knowledge to extraordinary practical uses, undreamt of until the past few hundred years. Today, at least among scientists, there is virtually universal agreement about the validity of the mathematical approach to understanding the physical world. Yet it took a very long time for that view to prevail. The acceptance of modern science as a metaphysical system based on the idea that nature behaves according to certain regularities originated with the Greeks. But science didn't achieve the first of its convincing successes at making use of these laws until the 17th century. That jump from the ideas of philosophers like Thales, Pythagoras, and Aristotle to those of Galileo and Newton was a great leap. Still, it needn't have taken 2,000 years. The first great stumbling block in the path to accepting and building on the Greek heritage was the Roman conquest of Greece in 146 BC and Mesopotamia in 64 BC. The rise of Rome was the beginning of centuries of declining interest in philosophy, mathematics, and science, even among the Greek-speaking intellectual elite, because the practical-minded Romans placed little stock in those fields of study. A remark by Cicero expresses nicely the Roman disdain for theoretical pursuits. The Greeks, he said, held the geometer in the highest honor. Accordingly, nothing made more brilliant progress among them than mathematics. But we have established as a limit of this art its usefulness in measuring and counting. And indeed, during the roughly 1,000-year duration of the Roman Republic and its successor, the Roman Empire, the Romans undertook vast and impressive engineering projects that were dependent, no doubt, upon much measuring and counting. But, as far as we know, they produced not one Roman mathematician of note. That is an astounding fact, and it stands as evidence of the enormous effect of culture on developments in mathematics and science. Though Rome did not provide an environment conducive to science, after the dissolution of the Western Roman Empire in 476 AD, things got even worse. Cities shrank, the feudal system arose, Christianity dominated Europe, and rural monasteries and later the cathedral schools became the centers of intellectual life, which meant that scholarship was focused on religious issues and inquiries into nature were considered frivolous or unworthy. Eventually, the intellectual heritage of the Greeks was lost to the Western world. Fortunately for science, in the Arab world, the ruling Muslim class did find value in Greek learning. That's not to say they pursued knowledge for its own sake. That stance was no more endorsed by Islamic ideology than by Christianity. But wealthy Arab patrons were willing to fund translations of Greek science into Arabic in the belief that Greek science was useful. And indeed, there was a period of hundreds of years during which medieval Islamic scientists made great progress in practical optics, astronomy, mathematics, and medicine, overtaking the Europeans, whose own intellectual tradition lay dormant. But by the 13th and 14th centuries, a time when the Europeans were awakening from their long slumber, science in the Islamic world had gone into serious decline. There seem to have been several factors at play. For one, conservative religious forces came to impose an ever narrower understanding of practical utility, which they considered to be the only acceptable justification for scientific investigation. Also, for science to flourish, society must be prosperous and offer possibilities for private or governmental patronage, because most scientists do not have the resources to support their work in an open market. In late medieval times, however, the Arab world came under attack by external forces, ranging from Genghis Khan to the Crusaders, and was torn asunder by internal factional warfare as well. Resources that might once have been devoted to the arts and sciences were now diverted to warfare and the struggle for survival. Another reason that the study of science began to stagnate was that the schools that came to dominate a significant segment of intellectual life in the Arab world didn't value it. Known as madrasas, these were charitable trusts sustained by religious endowments whose founders and benefactors were suspicious of the sciences. As a result, all instruction had to center on religion, to the exclusion of philosophy and science. Any teaching of those subjects thus had to occur outside the colleges. With no institution to support them or bring them together, scientists became isolated from one another, which created a huge barrier to specialized scientific training and research. Scientists cannot exist in a vacuum. Even the greatest profit immensely from their interaction with others in their field. The lack of peer-to-peer contact in the Islamic world prevented the cross-fertilization of ideas necessary for progress. Also, without the salutary benefits of mutual criticism, it became hard to control the proliferation of theories that lacked empirical grounding, and difficult to find a critical mass of support for those scientists and philosophers with views that challenged the conventional wisdom. Something comparable to this kind of intellectual suffocation occurred in China, another grand civilization that could conceivably have developed modern science before the Europeans. In fact, China had a population of more than 100 million people during the High Middle Ages, 1200 to 1500, roughly double the population of Europe at the time. But the educational system in China proved, like that of the Islamic world, far inferior to the one that was developing in Europe, at least with respect to science. It was rigidly controlled and focused on literary and moral learning, with little attention paid to scientific innovation and creativity. That situation remained virtually unchanged from the early Ming Dynasty around 1368 until the 20th century. As in the Arab world, only modest advances in science, as opposed to technology, were achieved, and they came despite and not because of the educational system. Thinkers who were critical of the intellectual status quo and who attempted to develop and systematize the intellectual tools necessary to push the life of the mind forward were strongly discouraged, as was the use of data as a means of advancing knowledge. In India, too, a Hindu establishment focused on caste structure insisted on stability at the expense of intellectual advance. As a result, though the Arab world, China, and India did produce great thinkers in other realms, they produced no scientists equivalent to those who, in the West, would create modern science. The revival of science in Europe began toward the end of the 11th century, when the Benedictine monk Constantinus Africanus began to translate ancient Greek medical treatises from Arabic to Latin. As had been the case in the Arab world, the motivation to study Greek wisdom lay in its utility, and these early translations whetted the appetite for the translation of other practical works in medicine and astronomy. Then, in 1085, during the Christian reconquest of Spain, whole libraries of Arabic books fell into Christian hands, and over the next decades, large numbers were translated, thanks in part to generous funding from interested local bishops. It's hard to imagine the impact of the newly available works. It was as if a contemporary archaeologist had stumbled on and translated tablets of ancient Babylonian text and found that they presented advanced scientific theories far more sophisticated than our own. Over the next few centuries, sponsorship of the translations became a status symbol among the social and commercial elite of the Renaissance. As a result, the recovered knowledge spread beyond the church and became a kind of currency, collected as the wealthy today might collect art. And indeed, the wealthy would display their books and maps as one might today display a sculpture or painting. Eventually, the new value placed on knowledge independent of its utilitarian value led to an appreciation of scientific inquiry. In time, this undermined the church's ownership of truth. In competition with truth as revealed in the scriptures and in church tradition, there was now a rival truth, the truth as revealed by nature. But merely translating and reading ancient Greek works does not a scientific revolution make. It was the development of a new institution, the university, that would really transform Europe. It would become the driver of the development of science as we know it today, and it would keep Europe in the forefront of science for many centuries, producing the greatest strides in science the world had ever known. The revolution in education was fueled by growing affluence and a multitude of career opportunities for the well-educated. Cities like Bologna, Paris, Padua, and Oxford acquired reputations as centers of learning, and both students and teachers gravitated to them in large numbers. Teachers would set up shop, either independently or under the auspices of an existing school. Eventually, they organized into voluntary associations modeled after the trade guilds. But though the associations called themselves universities, these were at first simply alliances, owning no real estate and having no fixed location. Universities in the sense that we know them came decades later. Bologna in 1088, Paris around 1200, Padua around 1222, and Oxford by 1250. There, natural science, not religion, would become the focus, and scholars would come together to interact and stimulate one another. That's not to say that the university in medieval Europe was the Garden of Eden. As late as 1495, for example, German authorities saw the need for a statute explicitly forbidding anyone associated with the university from drenching freshmen with urine, a statute that no longer exists, but that I still require my own students to adhere to. Professors, for their part, often had no dedicated classroom and were thus forced to lecture in rooming houses, churches, even brothels. Worse, professors were commonly paid directly by the students, who could also hire and fire them. At the University of Bologna, there was another bizarre twist on what is the norm today. Students fined their professors for unexcused absence or tardiness, or for not answering difficult questions. And if a lecture was not interesting or proceeded too slowly or too quickly, they would jeer and become rowdy. Aggressive tendencies got so out of hand in Leipzig that the university had to pass a rule against throwing stones at professors. Despite these practical hardships, the European universities were great enablers of scientific progress, in part because of the way they brought people together to share and debate ideas. Scientists can withstand distractions like jeering students and perhaps even occasional flying urine. But to go without endless academic seminars, that's just unthinkable. Today, most scientific advances stem from university research, as they must because that is where the lion's share of funding for basic research goes. But just as important, historically, has been the role of the university as a gathering place of minds. The scientific revolution that would distance us from Aristotelianism, transform our views of nature and even society, and lay the groundwork for who we are today, is often said to have begun with Copernicus's heliocentric theory and to have culminated in Newton's physics. But that picture is oversimplified. Though I use the term scientific revolution as a convenient shorthand, the scientists involved had a wide variety of goals and beliefs, rather than being a united bunch deliberately striving together to create a new system of thought. Even more important, the changes the scientific revolution refers to were actually gradual. The great scholars of 1550 to 1700, who built the grand cathedral of knowledge whose pinnacle was Newton, did not emerge from nowhere. It was the medieval thinkers at the early universities of Europe who did the back-breaking work of digging the foundation for them. The greatest of that work was accomplished by a group of mathematicians at Merton College, Oxford, between 1325 and 1359. Most people know, at least vaguely, that the Greeks invented the idea of science and that it was in the time of Galileo that modern science came into being. Medieval science, though, gets little respect. That's a shame, because medieval scholars made surprising progress, despite living in an age in which people routinely judged the truth of statements, not according to empirical evidence, but by how well they fit into their pre-existing system of religion-based beliefs, a culture that is inimical to science as we know it today. Philosopher John Searle wrote about an incident that illustrates the fundamentally different terms in which we and medieval thinkers see the world. He told of a Gothic church in Venice called the Madonna dell'Oro, Madonna of the Orchard. The original plan was to call it the Church of San Cristoforo, but while it was being built, a statue of the Madonna mysteriously turned up in an adjoining orchard. The name change came because the statue was assumed to have fallen from heaven, an event that was considered a miracle. There was no more doubt then about that supernatural explanation than there would be now about the earthly interpretation that we would assign such an incident. Even if the statue were found in the gardens of the Vatican, Searle wrote, the church authorities would not claim it had fallen out of heaven. I brought up the accomplishments of medieval scientists at a party once. I said I was quite impressed by their work, given their culture and the hardships they faced. We scientists today complain about the time wasted applying for grants, but at least we have heated offices and don't have to hunt cats for dinner when our town's agricultural production takes a dip. Not to mention having to escape the Black Death, which came in 1347 and killed half the population. The party I was at was heavy in academics, so the person I was talking to didn't react to my musings the way most people would have, by suddenly realizing she needed to go refill her Chardonnay. Instead, she said incredulously, "Medieval scientists? Come on. They operated on patients without anesthetic. They made healing potions out of lettuce juice, hemlock, and gall from a castrated boar. And didn't even the great Thomas Aquinas himself believe in witches?" She had me there. I had no idea. But I looked it all up later, and she was right. Yet despite her apparently encyclopedic knowledge of certain aspects of medieval medical scholarship, she hadn't heard of their more lasting ideas in the realm of physical science, which seemed to me all the more miraculous, given the state of medieval knowledge in other fields. And so, though I had to concede that one would not want to be treated by a medieval doctor who traveled to the present-day world in a time machine, I stood my ground with regard to the progress those medieval scholars had made in the physical sciences. What did they do, these forgotten heroes of physics? To start with, among all the types of change considered by Aristotle, they singled out change of position, that is motion, as being most fundamental. That was a deep and prescient observation, because most types of change we observe are specific to the substances involved, the rotting of meat, the evaporation of water, the falling of leaves from a tree. As a result, they wouldn't yield much to a scientist looking for the universal. The laws of motion, on the other hand, are fundamental laws that apply to all matter. But there's another reason the laws of motion are special. On the submicroscopic level, they are the cause of all the macroscopic changes we experience in our lives. That's because, as we now know, and as some of the ancient Greek atomists had speculated, the many kinds of change we experience in the everyday world can ultimately be understood by analyzing the laws of motion that operate on the fundamental building blocks of materials, atoms and molecules. Though the Merton scholars did not discover those comprehensive laws of motion, they did intuit that such laws existed, and they set the stage for others to discover them centuries later. In particular, they created a rudimentary theory of motion that had nothing to do with the science of other types of change, and nothing to do with the idea of purpose. The task the Merton scholars assumed wasn't an easy one, given that the mathematics required for even the simplest analysis of motion was still primitive at best. But there was another serious handicap, and to overcome it was an even greater triumph than to succeed with the limited mathematics of the era, for it was not a technical barrier, but a limitation imposed by the way people thought about the world. The Merton scholars were, like Aristotle, hampered by a worldview in which time played a mostly qualitative and subjective role. We who are steeped in the culture of the developed world experience the passage of time in a way that people of earlier eras would not recognize. For most of humankind's existence, time was a highly elastic framework that stretched and contracted in a completely private manner. Learning to think of time as anything but inherently subjective was a difficult and far-reaching step forward, as great an advance for science as the development of language or the realization that the world could be understood through reason. For example, to search for regularities in the timing of events, to imagine that for a rock to fall 16 feet will always require 1 second, would have been a revolutionary concept in the era of the Merton scholars. For one, no one had any idea how to measure time with any precision, and the concept of minutes and seconds was virtually unheard of. In fact, the first clock to record hours of equal length wasn't invented until the 1330s. Before that, daylight, however long, had been divided into 12 equal intervals, which meant that an hour might be more than twice as long in June as in December. In London, for example, it varied from 38 to 82 of today's minutes. That this didn't bother anyone reflects the fact that people had very little use for anything but a vague and qualitative notion of time's passage. In light of that, the idea of speed, distance traveled per unit time, must have seemed an oddball one indeed. Given all the obstacles, it seems miraculous that the Merton scholars managed to create a conceptual foundation for the study of motion. And yet, they went so far as to state the first ever quantitative rule of motion, the Merton rule. The distance traversed by an object that accelerates from rest at a constant rate is equal to the distance traversed by an object that moves for the same amount of time at half the accelerating object's top speed. Admittedly, that's a mouthful. Although I've long been familiar with it, looking at it now, I had to read it twice just to follow what it was saying. But the opacity of the rule's phrasing serves a purpose, for it illustrates how much easier science would become once scientists learn to use, and invent if necessary, the appropriate mathematics. In today's mathematical language, the distance traversed by an object that accelerates from rest at a constant rate can be written as 1/2 at squared. The second quantity, the distance traversed by an object that moves for the same amount of time at half the accelerating object's top speed, is simply 1/2 at times t. Thus, the above statement of the Merton rule, translated mathematically, becomes 1/2 at squared equals 1/2 at times t. That's not just more compact. It also makes the truth of the statement instantly obvious, at least to anyone who has had pre-algebra. If those days are far behind you, just ask a sixth grader. He or she will understand it. In fact, the average sixth grader today knows far more mathematics than even the most advanced 14th century scientist. Whether an analogous statement will be said of 28th century children and 21st century scientists is an interesting question. Certainly, human mathematics prowess has, for centuries, been steadily progressing. An everyday example of what the Merton rule is saying is this. If you accelerate your car steadily from 0 to 100 miles per hour, you'll go the same distance as if you had driven at 50 the entire time. It sounds like my mother nagging me about driving too fast, but though the Merton rule is today common sense, the Merton scholars were unable to prove it. Still, the rule made quite a splash in the intellectual world, and it quickly diffused to France, Italy, and other parts of Europe. The proof came soon after from across the Channel, where the French counterparts of the Merton scholars worked at the University of Paris. Its author was Nicole Orem, a philosopher and theologian who would eventually rise to the post of Bishop of Lisieux. To achieve his proof, Orem had to do what physicists throughout history have done repeatedly, invent new mathematics. If mathematics is the language of physics, a lack of appropriate mathematics makes a physicist unable to speak or even reason about a topic. The complex and unfamiliar math Einstein needed to use to formulate general relativity may be why he once advised a young schoolgirl, "Do not worry about your difficulties in mathematics. I can assure you that mine are still greater." Or, as Galileo put it, "The book of nature cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language and read the letters in which it is composed. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometrical figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one is wandering around in a dark labyrinth." To shine a light on that dark labyrinth, Orem invented a type of diagram intended to represent the physics of the Merton rule. Though he didn't understand his diagrams in the same way we do today, one might consider this to be the first geometric representation of the physics of motion, and thus, the first graph. I've always found it strange that many people know who invented calculus, though few people ever use it, while few people know who invented the graph, though everyone uses them. I suppose that's because today the idea of graphs seems obvious. But in medieval times, the idea of representing quantities with lines and forms in space was strikingly original and revolutionary, maybe even a little nutty. To get an idea of the difficulty in achieving even a simple change in the way people think, I'd like to remember the story of another nutty invention, a decidedly non-mathematical one, Post-it notes, those small pieces of paper with a strip of reusable adhesive on one side that allows them to be easily attached to things. The Post-it note was invented in 1974 by Art Fry, a chemical engineer at the 3M company. Suppose, though, that they had not been invented back then, and that today I came to you, an investor, with the idea and a prototype pad of notes. Surely you'd recognize the invention as a gold mine and jump at the opportunity to invest, right? Outlandish as it may seem, most people probably wouldn't, as evidenced by the fact that when Fry presented his idea to the marketing people at 3M, a company known for both their adhesives and their innovations, they were unenthusiastic and believed they'd have a hard time selling something that would have to command a premium price compared with the scratch paper it was intended to replace. Why didn't they rush to embrace the treasure Fry was offering them? Because in the pre-Post-it era, the notion that you might want to stick scraps of paper striped with weak adhesive on things was beyond people's imagination. And so Albert Fry's challenge was not just to invent the product, but to change the way people thought. If that was an uphill battle with regard to the Post-it note, one can only imagine the degree of difficulty one faces when trying to do the same in a context that really matters. Luckily, Orem didn't need Post-it notes for his proof. Here is how we would interpret his arguments. To begin, place time along the horizontal axis and velocity along the vertical axis. Now suppose the object you are considering starts at time zero and moves for a while at constant speed. That motion is represented by a horizontal line. If you shade in the area below that line, you get a rectangle. Constant acceleration, on the other hand, is represented by a line that rises at some angle because as time increases, so does velocity. If you shade in the region below that line, you have a triangle. The area under these curves, the shaded areas, represents speed multiplied by time, which is the distance the object has traveled. Employing this analysis, and knowing how to calculate the areas of rectangles and triangles, it is then easy to demonstrate the validity of the Merton rule. One reason Orem doesn't get the credit he deserves is that he did not publish many of his works. In addition, though I've explained how we would interpret his work today, the conceptual framework he actually used was not nearly as detailed and quantitative as I described, and was utterly different from our modern understanding of the relationship between mathematics and physical quantities. That new understanding would spring from a series of innovations regarding the concepts of space, time, velocity, and acceleration that would be one of the most significant contributions of the great Galileo Galilei. Though medieval scholars working in the universities of the 13th and 14th centuries had progressed in furthering the tradition of a rational and empirical scientific method, the grand explosion of European science did not immediately follow. Instead, it was the inventors and engineers who transformed European society and culture in late medieval Europe, a period concurrent with the first stirrings of the Renaissance, which spanned roughly from the 14th to the 17th centuries. These early Renaissance innovators created the first great civilization not powered primarily by the exertion of human muscle. Water wheels, windmills, new kinds of mechanical linkages, and other devices were developed or improved and incorporated into village life. They powered sawmills, flour mills, and a variety of clever machines. Their technological innovations had little to do with theoretical science, but they did lay the groundwork for later advances by generating new wealth that helped foster a rise in learning and literacy, and by promoting the realization that an understanding of nature can aid the human condition. The entrepreneurial spirit of the early Renaissance also saw the invention of one technology that had a direct and major impact on later science, as well as on society in general, the printing press. Though the Chinese had developed movable type centuries earlier, around 1040, it was relatively impractical due to the use of pictograms in Chinese writing, which created the need for thousands of different characters. In Europe, however, the appearance of mechanical movable type printing around 1450 changed everything. In 1483, for example, to set up a book for printing, the Ripoli Press charged three times what a scribe would charge to copy the book. But with their setup, Ripoli would produce 1,000 or more copies, while a scribe would produce only one. As a result, within just a few decades, more books had been printed than the scribes of Europe had produced in all the preceding centuries combined. The printing press strengthened the emerging middle class and revolutionized the circulation of thoughts and information throughout Europe. Knowledge and information suddenly became available to a far wider group of citizens. Within a few years, the first math texts were printed, and by 1600, almost 1,000 had been published. In addition, there came a new wave in the recovery of ancient texts. Just as important, those with new ideas suddenly had a far larger forum for their views, and those who, like scientists, thrived on scrutinizing and furthering the ideas of others soon had far greater access to the work of their cohorts. As a result of these changes in European society, its establishment was less fixed and uniform than that of the Islamic world, China, or India. Those societies had become rigid and focused on a narrow orthodoxy. The European elite, meanwhile, found themselves tugged and bent by the competing interests of town and country, church and state, pope and emperors, as well as the demands of a new lay intelligentsia and growing consumerism. And so, As European society evolved, its arts and its science had more freedom to change, and they did, resulting in a new and more practical interest in nature. In both the arts and science, that new emphasis on natural reality became the soul of the Renaissance. The term itself is French for rebirth, and indeed the Renaissance represented a new beginning in both physical existence and culture. It began in Italy, just after the Black Death killed between a third and half of Europe's population, then spread slowly, not reaching northern Europe until the 16th century. In art, Renaissance sculptors learned anatomy and painters learned geometry, both focusing on creating more faithful representations of reality based on keen observation. Human figures were now rendered in natural surroundings, and with anatomical accuracy, and three-dimensionality was suggested through the use of light and shadow and linear perspective. Painter subjects also now showed realistic emotion, their faces no longer displaying the flat, otherworldly quality of earlier medieval art. Renaissance musicians, meanwhile, studied acoustics, while architects scrutinized the harmonic proportions of buildings. And scholars interested in natural philosophy, what we today call science, placed a new emphasis on gathering data and drawing conclusions from it, rather than employing pure logical analysis biased by a desire to confirm their religious worldview. Leonardo da Vinci perhaps best epitomizes the scientific and humanist ideal of that period, which did not recognize a stark separation between science and the arts. A scientist, engineer, and inventor, he was also a painter, sculptor, architect, and musician. In all these pursuits, Leonardo tried to understand the human and natural worlds through detailed observation. His notes and studies in science and engineering consume more than 10,000 pages, while as a painter, he wasn't content to merely observe posing subjects, but also studied anatomy and dissected human corpses. Where prior scholars had viewed nature in terms of general qualitative features, Leonardo and his contemporaries invested enormous effort in perceiving the fine points of nature's design and placed less emphasis on the authority of both Aristotle and the Church. It was into this intellectual climate, toward the end of the Renaissance, that Galileo was born. In Pisa in 1564, just 2 months before the birth of another Titan, William Shakespeare. Galileo was the first of 7 children of Vincenzo Galilei, a well-known lute player and music theorist. Vincenzo came from a noble family, not the kind of noble family we think of today, people who go on fox hunts and sip tea every afternoon, but the kind that has to use its name to get a job. Vincenzo probably wished he were a nobleman of the first kind, as he loved the lute and played it whenever possible, walking in town, riding a horse, standing at the window, lying in bed, a practice that brought him little in cold cash. Hoping to guide his son toward a lucrative way of life, Vincenzo sent young Galileo to study medicine at the University of Pisa. But Galileo was more interested in math than in medicine, and he began to take private lessons in the works of Euclid and Archimedes, and even Aristotle. He told friends many years later that he would have preferred to forego university training and instead take up drawing and painting. Vincenzo, however, had pushed him toward a more practical pursuit on the age-old fatherly theory that it is worth certain compromises to avoid a life where dinner means hemp seed soup and beef entrails. When Vincenzo heard that Galileo had turned toward mathematics rather than medicine, it must have seemed as if he'd chosen to major in living off his inheritance, as inadequate as it would be. But it hardly mattered. In the end, Galileo didn't complete a degree in medicine, math, or anything else. He dropped out and began a life journey that would indeed find him chronically short of money and often in debt. After quitting school, Galileo at first supported himself by giving private mathematics lessons. He eventually got wind of an opening for a junior position at the University of Bologna. Though he was 23, he applied, and in a novel twist on rounding, he reported his age as around 26. The university apparently wanted someone around a little older, and hired a 32-year-old who had also actually finished his degree. Still, even centuries later, it has to be comforting to anyone who has ever been turned down for an academic job that it's an experience you share with the great Galileo. 2 years later, Galileo did become a professor in Pisa. There, he taught his beloved Euclid and also a course on astrology aimed at helping medical students determine when to bleed patients. Yes, the man who did so much to further the scientific revolution also advised aspiring doctors on what the position of Aquarius means for the placement of leeches. Today, astrology has been discredited, but in the age before we knew very much about the laws of nature, the idea that heavenly bodies affect our lives here on Earth seemed to be a reasonable one. After all, it is true of the sun and also the moon, which had long been known to have a mysterious correlation with the tides. Galileo made astrological forecasts both out of personal interest and for profit, charging his students 12 scudi for a reading. At 5 per year, he could double his 60 scudi teaching salary, a sum he could get by on, but just barely. He also liked to gamble, and in an era before anyone knew much about the mathematics of probability, Galileo was not only a pioneer in calculating odds, but also a good bluffer. In his late 20s, tall and stocky, with a fair complexion and reddish hair, Galileo was generally well-liked. But his tenure at Pisa didn't last long. Though generally respectful of authority, he was prone to sarcasm and could be scathing to both his intellectual adversaries and administrators who rubbed him the wrong way. The rubbing that inflamed him at Pisa came when the university stubbornly insisted that professors don their academic gowns around town, as well as when they were teaching. Galileo, who liked to write poetry, retaliated by writing a poem for the university authorities. Its subject was clothing. Galileo came out against it. It is, he argued, a source of deceit. For example, without clothes, his verses proclaimed, a bride could look at her prospective mate and see if he is too small or has French diseases, and thus informed, take or leave him as she pleases. Not a poem likely to endear you to Parisians. It didn't go over well in Pisa either, and young Galileo was again on the job market. As it turned out, that was all for the good. Galileo promptly received an appointment near Venice at the university in Padua, starting at 180 scudi per year, triple his former salary, and he would later describe his sojourn there as the best 18 years of his life. By the time Galileo got to Padua, he was disenchanted with Aristotelian physics. For Aristotle, science consisted of observation and theorizing. For Galileo, that was missing a crucial step, the use of experiments. And in Galileo's hands, experimental physics advanced as much as its theoretical side. Scholars had been performing experiments for centuries, but they were generally done to illustrate ideas that they already accepted. Today, on the other hand, scientists perform experiments to rigorously test ideas. Galileo's experiments fell somewhere in between. They were explorations more than illustrations, but not quite rigorous tests. Two aspects of Galileo's approach to experiments are especially important. First, when he got a result that surprised him, he didn't reject it. He questioned his own thinking. Second, his experiments were quantitative, a rather revolutionary idea at the time. Galileo's experiments were much like those you might see performed in a high school science class today, though of course his lab differed from what you'd find in a high school in that it lacked electricity, gas, water, and fancy equipment. And by fancy equipment, I mean, for example, a clock. As a result, Galileo had to be a 16th century MacGyver, making complex devices from the Renaissance equivalent of duct tape and a toilet bowl plunger. For instance, to create a stopwatch, Galileo poked a small hole in the bottom of a large bucket. When he needed to time an event, he would fill the vessel with water, collect what leaked out, and weigh it. the weight of the water was proportional to the duration of the event. Galileo employed this water clock to attack the controversial issue of free fall, the process by which an object falls to the earth. To Aristotle, free fall was a type of natural motion governed by certain rules of thumb, such as, if half the weight moves the distance in a given time, its double, the whole weight, will take half the time. In other words, objects fall at a constant speed which is proportional to their weight. If you think about it, that's common sense. A rock falls faster than a leaf. And so, given the lack of measuring or recording instruments and the little that was known about the concept of acceleration, Aristotle's description of free fall must have seemed reasonable. But if you think again, it also violates common sense. As Jesuit astronomer Giovanni Riccioli would point out, even the mythological eagle that killed Aeschylus by dropping a turtle on his head knew instinctively that an object dropped on your head will do more damage if dropped from higher up, and that implies that objects speed up as they fall. As a result of such considerations, there was a long tradition of back and forth about this issue, with various scholars over the centuries having expressed skepticism about Aristotle's theory. Galileo was familiar with the criticisms and wanted to do his own investigation into the matter. However, he knew his water clock was not precise enough to allow him to experiment with falling objects, so he had to find a process that was slower, yet demonstrated the same physical principles. He settled upon measuring the time it took for highly polished bronze balls to roll down smooth planes that were inclined at various angles. Studying free fall by taking measurements of balls rolling down ramps is something like buying an outfit according to how it looks on the internet. There's always the chance that the clothes will look different on the actual you than on the gorgeous model. Despite the dangers, such reasoning lies at the core of the way modern physicists think. The art of designing a good experiment lies largely in knowing which aspects of a problem are important to preserve and which you can safely ignore, and in how to interpret your experimental results.